ideas of John Turner and the people he was working with at that time, Lisa Peetie, William Mangin, another very influential guy, Charles Abrams. And what they were saying at the time redefined what we mean by affordable and self-generated or locally generated housing. Now, what they did was to redefine the issue of what were considered to be unplanned settlements or slums. And this was a revolutionary idea for me, because what they were saying is that this is a resource, not a problem. It's part of the solution to the amazing challenge of urbanization and urban growth. Now, I had the great privilege, after I returned from doing my own research on slums and housing and urban development in India in 1971, that was the first time I heard about John Turner. So his ideas were a reconviction or a reinforcement of everything that I found when I was in Delhi looking at these issues. So it was very, very exciting when I had the opportunity to be his assistant director on a mid-career training program at the Development Planning Unit in University College London. And I'll never forget the first day of this lecture was to a group of very senior official planners and architects and engineers from all over the global south, very senior people. And he was talking in his introductory lecture about the need for communities to be actively involved in and participating in the decision-making and design of their houses and their settlements. And at the end of the lecture, he said, "We'll now take a break for coffee." And everyone sat there waiting for the door to come open and someone to come in with a trolley full of tea and coffee. John said, no, I'm talking about participation. And therefore, who's going to go and buy the coffee? Who's going to make it up? Who's going to do the washing up? And who's going to create the rota? And the look on their faces was stunning, because they suddenly realized that here was a lecturer who practiced what he preached. Everyone was going to have to take part. And I think probably that was the most significant moment for them of the whole course, because it made them realize that you can't just sit there as an expert and decide what needs to be done for other people. You have to be involved in making those decisions yourself. And that memory stays very, very strongly with me. And I think it also can, the whole experience was coming at a time when he was working in Peru in the 1960s, when urbanization was really getting underway at a mass scale, globally. And that was partly because of colonialization. The end of colonialism meant that people were free to move from rural areas where they were underpaid in agriculture to live in the possibilities that urban life offered, both for social change and for economic improvement. Now, of course, housing was a big problem. People had no money and governments weren't rich. So what were they going to do? What people did then, as John found in Peru, as I found in Delhi, and all of us found later on all over the world, people were taking the initiative themselves. They were not waiting for government to hand out. They weren't able to buy what the private sector could give. They took the law into their own hands, as we saw in the films, and they solved their own problem in their own way, according to their terms and priorities and conditions and resources. What they did, of course, was very, very different to what the conventions of urban planning that we'd all been taught in architecture schools and planning schools was the proper way of doing it, proper in inverted commas. Now, these settlements were generally widely regarded, as we saw in the film, as unplanned, unauthorized, informal, and therefore slums. But what they did do was to meet the needs on a regular basis for a vast number of people, coming into the urban areas. In the 1960s, many cities were expanding at about 7% a year. So the populations were doubling every 10 years. And that would be very, very difficult for any government to meet. And colonialism, as they say, has also cast a very, very long shadow. It may have ended in the 1940s, 50s and 60s. But for example, in India, the Land Registration Act, or the Land Acquisition Act, rather, of 1894, was only repealed in 2014. So you can see that the assumptions made under colonialism were continued by many governments after independence, because that's what they thought was a normal way of doing things. So what John has done, more than any other individual, I think, has to help to see the world in a different way. And that's an enormous legacy for anyone, or an enormous achievement. And as he said, this is an architecture that works. Now, after John's successful and very influential contribution to Habitat One in Vancouver in 1976, the World Bank expressed great interest in what he was doing. And as Eric said, they did a large number of sites and service projects, which was an attempt, a very genuine attempt, I think, to replicate, but on a top-down basis, what John had been doing on a bottom-up basis. In other words, the people from the bottom were dictating what they wanted and how to do it. Sites and services were an attempt by governments on a top-down basis to provide the land and the services on which people could then build their own housing. Now, what was interesting is that I think the bank quickly found that those projects were not a great success. The ones that I know of were quickly captured by certain individuals who subletted the units and then moved out and turned the whole thing into a business. And we saw that in the second film, later on in Peru, people took over these projects and turned them into profit-making businesses rather than community-based activities. And I think this is the great problem with housing that we've seen in the last few decades. And the root cause of that, if there is a single root cause, of course these things are complicated, but I would put the main problem down to the global introduction and exporting of neoliberal economic theory. Mm-hmm. As soon as you regard land and property and housing as financial assets rather than as places to live and raise a family as part of the community, that changes the whole nature of the operation. And when you've got massive competition for a scarce resource like land, under a neoliberal economic framework, the prices go up very, very quickly to levels that people cannot, or a large proportion of people cannot afford. And as you saw in the second film, people were building houses on the edge of Lima as a purely speculative venture in order to meet future needs when the services were provided. So they've turned it up into a business. Now, what I found very interesting is that the whole approach of housing as we now see it has turned into one in which the opportunities for the community-initiated development that John was advocating and reporting on have declined dramatically over recent years, mainly because of land becoming so unaffordable, and also, I think, because governments have become much more assertive in their ability to impose a market economy onto the situation. Now, although John indicated that communities need to have a much greater influence, I was asked if I would comment on the relationship of on his definition compared to that of Mike Davis, in his book Slum, Planet of Slums. Now, Davis defined John's approach as an amalgam of anarchism and neoliberalism. I would disagree with that. I think it's a wrong interpretation, because John has been considered by one or two people, by people on the extreme left, I would say, or people who were socialist, communist, basically. They accused him of being a laissez-faire liberal. I think that was a misunderstanding of what John is all about. My understanding of what John is about is neither left nor right, but top or down or bottom up. In other words, he doesn't see things in conventional ideological terms. He sees them much more in terms of the role of people within society. He sees it in social terms, not purely political terms. So I think people who criticize him have been mistaken in their interpretation of what he's saying. His argument, I think, is still valid in terms of wanting to promote community-based initiatives and increasing the role of people over the decisions that are made about who gets what. And that lesson is as relevant as it ever has been, but it's much more difficult to apply within a situation where governments are now quite authoritarian and where the market is making decisions and allocating resources. I'd like to show you, if I can, just a few quick slides, if I can share my screen, to go back to what I want to conclude with a few comments. Are you able to see my screen? Yes, can you see my screen? Is that a yes? Could you put your hand up, Eric, if you can see the screen? Okay, great, thank you very much. This is the work I did in the early 1970s in Ankara, where people were coming in the same way that they were in Peru, and building their own houses, settling in areas where people from their own areas were living, and then building their own houses on a standard format, using brick blocks in a pretty similar way to those found in Peru. Children were helping put the tiles on the roof. They could climb up easily. So everyone was involved. And what was great at that time was that the low-income groups had their own house, their own plot, surrounded by vegetation which they could grow for themselves, whereas the middle class, in the tall tower blocks on the right-hand side of the screen, they were actually living in much more constrained spaces without access to greenery. So what was very interesting then, at that time, I would argue that the poor had a better quality of housing and a better quality of life than the rich that you see in the background with very closely built apartment blocks. Now, a few of these areas still remain. I went back there 3 years ago, and some of those original settlements continue. But now they've been replaced by these tower blocks. And this is the new environment resulting from neoliberalism and strong government support for private investment, both domestic and foreign. And so this for me is the concern. But I hate to end my comments on a negative note. And I think what we need to see is a reinterpretation of what John has been promoting in a modern context. We have to accept that we're living in a world where market forces and government influence are very, very dominant, and the scope for the mass movements that John was promoting are much, much more limited. However, I do get great inspiration and hope from the young generation, the young girl aged 12 in Lima, who we saw in the second film, who has and the Greta Thunbergs and other people of the new generation, who have a much better grasp of what the world needs. And I think that the ideas that you see in this film, in this slide, are an example in Cambridge in the UK of co-housing, where the community owned the land and built the houses with a developer, with an architect, and at the end building, that's a community facility. And so communal ownership of land, I think, is a very important element. It's a very strong element in this report, which I did for UN Habitat, the role of land in achieving adequate and affordable housing. And what I think is vital, and which I stress in this report, and in my book, which is coming out in February, is that there's no point in just relying on the markets to meet people's needs. What we need to do is to have options outside the market. We need to promote cooperatives, social housing, community land trusts, communal leases, co-housing, multiple occupancy of housing, multi-generational housing, a whole range of ideas that can actually provide alternatives to these options that the market is determined to impose. And if you want an example of a complete city, which is moving, has moved in that direction, just look at Vienna. Mm-hmm. Nearly half of all the housing in Vienna can be classified as various forms of social housing. And, you know, of all the cities in the world, Vienna is one of the most cultured, vibrant, lively cities, and one that is, I think, a pathfinder in many respects as an exemplar of the sort of thing of social housing and the role of social housing that John has been so effectively advocating for so long. And I do regard him as a hero. So thank you very much indeed. Those are my comments. I hope they're helpful. Mm.
Thank you very much, Geoff. A very stimulating presentation. Drawing reliance also towards the ongoing discussion in Nordic and European capitals on the third hosting sector. So I think, as we have discussed, we would like to invite you back to Oslo, Norway, sometime in February, where we, Habitat Norway, will have an international conference on the so-called formalization agenda, which I think, as you well know, was initiated by another Peruvian, whose name I'm not going to mention. We have 10 minutes left. I really hope there are some questions. I would like to encourage you to ask questions both to Catherine, who is with us again. Thank you very much for that. And to Jeff. The floor is yours.
Yes, much better.
Tenants who have collectively owned the public housing and
benefit through committees and boards, and now we see a beginning dismantlement of this by forced privatization of these areas from the state and the municipalities, and that this citizens' democracy and local democracies are being very challenged and overrun by this privatization. So, yeah, it was really inspiring to see the movies and hearing the talks, but also, yeah, I'm just a bit critical.
Good. If you would like to start, I think we start with ladies. With the lady. Katrin. Comment?
Did you hear that? Good enough, Katrin.
Where are you? You were asking me if I wanted to comment, right?
Yes.
Well, I think the comment that was just made, an observation, very interesting observation, not so much to comment on, right? But in general, I think the interest, or I find it very interesting to connect cases, right? To see Lima, to see what Geoff was just explaining, to see India, to see Vienna, to see Scandinavia. And to see of how many dignified housing is such a topic everywhere, right? And the way of how to get there seems so difficult, even though John Turner and I very much agree with what Geoff Payne was just saying, this bringing it into a different view and regarding him nearly as a hero, I would do the same thing. And I think all these knowledges that he has brought into our field of work and our field of development planners, but also of architects and urbanists is so important, and we cannot estimate more to think about. We cannot underestimate the importance of including people into the decision making, right? So I think this is the same experience that we all, well, we might be sharing, and unfortunately it's not what happens quite often, and therefore we can only look at the good examples and can only go and see how we can reinforce these forces in a world where there's more and more this idea of land being an asset, land being something that's been turned into an asset that has nothing to do with what it should do, and the scarcity of land, also the grabbing of land that we saw in Lima in a small scale, but we can see that everywhere, also even in rural areas, is a major question and a major thing that we have to address as professionals also.
Thank you. Geoff, would you like to comment?
Thank you, yes. Thank you. I share the concerns that have just been made. Privatization of social housing, of course, has been common in the UK since Margaret Thatcher introduced it in 1980, the right to buy, at a very, very heavy discount. And I think it's probably one of the greatest ways of removing public assets at a terrible, terrible price. It's had such long-term structural impacts on the way that people look at housing in the UK that I think we're going to find it will need a crisis before we can get any significant change. And I think on a general level, whether it's Peru, Scandinavia, or the UK, what has happened now is that housing is no longer affordable, even to the middle income groups. And that's what makes it different.
True.
Conservatives would possibly argue, or reactionary people would say, well, we've always had poor people. There's always been poverty. It's a fact of life, survival of the fittest, learn to live with it. Yeah? We do what we can on a paternalistic basis, but some poor people just don't work, they're lazy, they're incapable, they're unintelligent, you know, we have to live with reality. That's the attitude of some people. But when it starts affecting them and their children, suddenly they see the world differently. Mm-hmm. Even my nice privately educated child, they will say, can't afford anywhere to live, even to rent. And suddenly we get traction for change. And I think we're getting to that point if we haven't already got to that point now. And I think when you see the conservative media complaining about the housing crisis, and when you get conservative governments admitting that the housing sector is broken, that is the possibility when those of us with ideas for progressive, realistic, pragmatic solutions, this is when we have a responsibility to do something, to get together, to get public support, to influence political decision making, and to affect real change. And I see that movement is coming very, very soon if it's not already with us. It could link up with the climate crisis and what young generation are doing about that. And I would like to hope that in the very near future, all of those progressive forces, of which I consider myself and Catherine and all of us here to be part of, can actually take this as and the pandemic as an opportunity. All of the climate crisis, the pandemic crisis, the housing crisis are all linked up, and we should take this as a possible opportunity to affect real change and open up. And we're not going to stop owning houses, of course not. But what we are saying is that there should be a much wider choice in future housing of different forms of land tenure, property rights and decision-making processes. And all the examples are already in the public domain. All we have to do is draw on them. That's what I've said in my book. So I use this book to get it all off my chest. And I think if we can help to mobilize that, we will see significant progress, I hope, in the years to come.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Geoff. In a way, you provided the concluding remark, comments, all this workshop. We hope to continue the cooperation. Thank you very much also to Katrin. We will already see you tomorrow in Trondheim, where we are running another event in cooperation with the university and with Trondheim Association for Housing and Planning. So, thank you very much, all of you. My final comment or recommendation is that you all become members of Habitat Norway. The most important of all small urban advocacy organizations, but with the biggest board. We are a very voluntary organization. We need new members, we need new activists, and we hope to see some of you pretty soon. Thank you very much. And of course, thanks to Marikin, the two of you, for excellent preparations and implementation of this workshop. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Eric. All the very best. Well done, Catherine.
The great. Same from my side. Thank you so much for your excellent comments and for this great, great talk.
All the best.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.